Tonight will range from the upper 20s in northern Wisconsin to the upper 50s across southwest Missouri. In Champaign-Urbana today, mostly cloudy through the afternoon with a high only around 58 degrees. Winds out of the east at 15 to 20, but gusting to around 25 miles per hour. Tonight, showers and isolated thunderstorms likely, especially after midnight with the low around 45. Tomorrow, there's a 50-50 chance of showers and thunderstorms with the high around 63. We could see some gusty winds Saturday morning out of the east around 25 miles per hour. Saturday night, mostly cloudy, a slight chance of showers with the low about 41. And on Sunday, partly sunny with the high around 58 degrees. Now, there is a chance of rain in the forecast Sunday night through Wednesday with highs in the upper 60s to near 80 and lows in the mid-40s to lower 60s. Around the region at this hour, in Carbondale, clear skies, 58 degrees. In Chicago, we have mostly cloudy skies, 50 degrees. It's clear in 53 in Danville, clear in 54 in Decatur. Clear skies, 56 degrees in Mattoon. In Indianapolis, mostly cloudy skies, 52 degrees. Clear in 57 in Terre Haute, Indiana. And at Willard Airport in Champaign, clear skies at the top of the hour, 56 degrees, with winds out of the east at 12 miles per hour, gusting to about 23 miles per hour. The relative humidity, 30.22 inches and steady. That's the barometric pressure, 30.22 inches and steady. Humidity at 22%. And outside our studios here in Urbana, it's 54 degrees at 12:39. Listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen in for Celeste Quinn, who returns on Monday. A team from the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois has helped filmmakers portray science on the big screen. Tomorrow, in one of the free panel discussions connected to the 14th annual Ebert Fest, NCSA Professor of Art and Design Donna Cox will explain the process by which her team visualized the first stars in the universe in the Terrence Malick film The Tree of Life. When it opened in Champaign last year, Illinois Public Media's Celeste Quinn spoke with Cox about working on the film and how Malick got in touch with the NCSA team.
I had worked with Bob Patterson and the team at NCSA on Cosmic Voyage, the IMAX film that was nominated for an Academy Award. And Terrence Malick had seen it, and they contacted me at SIGGRAPH. I was there in Los Angeles for a big conference of 27,000 professionals at a computer graphics conference, and his producer, Nick Gonda, was there, and they got me on the telephone with Terrence Malick, and he said, "I loved your Cosmic Voyage visualizations, and we really want you to participate in this film." And right away, we resonated on books we'd read, similar books on science and our beliefs around incorporating and converging science and art. And we were very enthusiastic right away to work on the film, because having a feature film that really shows real science and is inspirational is right part of our mission at NCSA.
Yeah, maybe you could talk a little bit about that. I'm really interested in these questions. What is the role of imagination in science, and what's the role of science in art?
Well, certainly back in the Renaissance, art and science were converging both in people and in teams. There were books that were published that were by artists and science teams. And today we see those kinds of teams in film today, in Pixar, Industrial Light and Magic, where the role of science is, for example, in the movie The Perfect Storm, all of the physics behind that those special effects comes right out of scientific research. So our team has really been involved in creating cinematic science, bringing scientific supercomputer simulations to large-scale venues such as museums and digital dome productions, IMAX films. But we treat science artistically. We cinematically design it. Bob Patterson is a cinematographer. We have artists on the team. We have technical experts. And we collaborate directly with scientists to bring science to the public in a very artistic way.
What precisely was the assignment from Malik and his team?
Well, first, they knew they wanted our very famous University of Illinois model of the Milky Way galaxy, and our virtual flights through the galaxy have really been inspirational, and we've done those virtual flights for other films like Hubble 3D IMAX film and Discovery Channel programs and PBS programs. That they knew they wanted this virtual, mysterious flight through this incredible galaxy with dust and something that we could really grab hold and feel that emergence taking place in the shots. The other assignment was much more exploratory. They wanted us to work with a Volker Braun, a scientist who did a supercomputer simulation in Austin, and we took that data at NCSA and we explored all of the parameters working with Dan Glass, the visual effects supervisor, and iterated an entire summer on that, trying to explore. Volker ran the simulation. It was just wonderful, but they didn't use 90% of what we developed, and they incorporated those elements with some of the work that Double Negative did. But it was very much when Dan Glass said, now, we're going to have you go down an exploration, what we were exploring was how to use this enormous simulation of the birth of a star, the birth and the death of a star, the death of this cosmic phenomenon, and make it feel emotional, bring emotion to the science. And that was a tough assignment because usually we are working directly with data and we're very true to the data.
Yeah, how do you make that emotional? I imagine that the filmmaker can do things with cutting back and forth between things or use music to get us to that point where he wants us to be. But without all that, how did you approach the problem?
We slowed everything down. Everything was slower. We really amped up the drama of the choreography, of the cinematic flow, timing of the different explosions to bring them out and to have a climax. All of these things help to evoke emotion and convey emotion, the darkness, the mysterious. But everything, I would say the key thing was we slowed everything down to these choreographies and this mysteriousness and added dust and tried not to be so clear. Computer graphics can just be too clear. Actually, nature has a lot of dirt in it. And you want to make sure you capitalize on all that dirt, you know.
Donna Cox is a professor of art and design and part of the team at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois. She spoke with Celeste Quinn last June. Cox and Robert Patterson will lead a discussion about their work on the Tree of Life tomorrow morning at 9:30 in the Illini Union as part of EbertFest. The event is free and open to the public. The first round of the pro football draft was held last night in New York's Radio City Music Hall. The top two picks, Andrew Luck and Robert Griffin III, are two of the most highly regarded quarterbacks to enter the NFL in years. And their selection was only the start. NPR's Mike Pesca reports.
Thursday was a great sports night for New Yorkers. The Mets had already won a day game in the bottom of the ninth. The Knicks were playing the last game of their season, their best season in over a decade. The Devils were in a deciding game seven of their NHL playoff series. They managed to win in double overtime. And the Rangers were also victorious in their own game seven.
Rangers try to play it on back, and they do. Here's step up, and the man across, score!
NBC Sports with the call. But for all the action on skates, spikes, or in high tops, it was the men wearing Oxfords and loafers who ran away with most of the attention. The National Football League draft, held in Radio City Music Hall, isn't a game, though the selection of college players usually has drama and uncertainty. Usually, the Indianapolis Colts confirmed their intentions a week ago. Some off-Broadway plays don't have as much rehearsal time as NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell did to deliver this line.
With the first pick in the 2012 NFL Draft, the Indianapolis Colts select Andrew Luck, quarterback, Stanford.
Luck's a phenomenal talent with the assured manner you'd expect from a worldly Stanford architect. In fact, in a press conference, he threatened to undo the draft's careful architecture of endlessly comparing newcomers to established stars.
Try not to get caught up too much in comparing yourself to other guys, because at the end of the day, you know, you're either going to devalue yourself in your mind, devalue someone. You know, realize everybody's different. Everybody goes into different situations. Just try to do the best you can. And I know that's terribly cliche, but
But it's practically unthinkable for a pro athlete to acknowledge and decry a cliche. They usually take up residence in the cliche's nurturing embrace. Luck's poise is almost as eye-opening as anything he could do with his right arm. It's the legs of Robert Griffin III that elevate him to elite status. The Heisman Trophy winner is known for his athleticism, great arm, and his habit of wearing unusual socks. Thursday's pair came with this message.
Go catch your dream. It's just telling people, you know, sometimes a sock can go a long ways. And everywhere I go somewhere, they're like, hey, Rob, what socks you wearing? So I knew it would happen, and I wanted to just get that message out there.
The Redskins made a big trade weeks ago to get Griffin. They were the first of a half dozen teams to trade up in the early part of this draft. The Browns, drafting third, took running back Trent Richardson, the first of four Alabama players taken Thursday. And every draft has the polarizing player, who some see as savior, others as substandard. This year it was Ryan Tannehill, the Texas A&M quarterback, who gurus like the aggressively coiffed Mel Kiper cast their doubts on.
Game management's an issue. Forces the ball into coverage. Questionable reads. Too many ill-advised throws. What he's got to do, hey, throw the ball away.
Is this guy a top 10 overall pick or the last player on the bench? The Dolphins thought he was worth the eighth pick. It is looking unlikely that any of these players selected will appear in a Pro Bowl. That's because news reports say the NFL is considering suspending its end-of-year All-Star game. That coronation of the game's best players, based on watching them actually play over a 16-game season, is somehow less captivating than this festival of hats, handshakes, and hope. Draft rounds 2 and 3 take place tonight. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
Hi, this is Station Manager Bob Culkeen. Thank you to the 583 listeners who made a pledge of support during our April pledge drive. With your support, you help raise more than $76,533 for WILL. We are still a little shy of our April goal. If you are not able to pledge during our drive, please consider a gift. Go to WILLpledge.org to make your contribution. Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 27th of April, 2012. It's the birthday of August Wilson, born Pittsburgh, 1945, son of a German baker, an African-American cleaning woman, grew up in the Hill District of Pittsburgh with his mother, five siblings, in two rooms, no hot water. They all shared the yard out back. His mother, Daisy Wilson, taught the boy to read when he was four, and a year later, he got his first library card. He was a bright boy, but he suffered from racism in school, dropped out when he was 15 because a teacher accused him of plagiarizing a paper about Napoleon because she didn't think a black student could have written anything so good. So he taught himself at the library. He read Richard Wright, Langston Hughes, Ralph Ellison, joined the army, started writing poetry. When he was 20, his father died, and he dropped his father's name, Kittle, and took his mother's name, Wilson. And he and a friend started a theater company in the Hill District where he grew up, staged his first play in 1973. When he was 33, August Wilson moved to St. Paul, Minnesota. He took a job at the Science Museum, writing scripts, adapting Native American stories. Sent a play to the Playwright Center in Minneapolis. He won a Jerome Fellowship. His play Jitney was produced, set in the Hill District in the 1970s. And then came Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, set in the 20s. Fences, set in the 60s. Joe Turner's Come and Gone, set in 1911. August Wilson set out to chronicle African-American experience through the 20th century, decade by decade, and his final play in his 10-part Pittsburgh cycle was Radio Golf, which is set in the 90s. It premiered in 2005, and Wilson died of liver cancer 6 months later. August Wilson said, "My greatest influence has been the blues," and that's a literary influence, because I think the blues is the best literature that we as Black Americans have. Blues is the bedrock of everything I do. If all this were to disappear off the face of the earth, and some people 2 million years from now would dig out this civilization and come across some blues records, they would be able to piece together who these people were, what they thought about, what their ideas and attitudes toward pleasure and pain were, all of that, all the components of culture. And it's the birthday of the author of the Madeleine books, Ludwig Bemelmans, born in the Tyrol, Austria, 1898, came to New York when he was 16, worked at a series of hotels, started his own restaurant, which became successful. And then a friend of his, who was in publishing, saw Bemelmans' drawings on the walls of his apartment, suggested he write a children's book, and that was Madeleine.